evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey, and my name is Dick. You'll also hear Kilo 2 Kilo Echo Yankee. His name is Mel. Mel and Dick attempt to organize this very enthusiastic crew that meets most Sunday evenings at 8 o'clock to discuss their favorite subject, ham radio. And there's 26 different kinds of ham radio, so there's lots of stuff to discuss. During the first hour, those who sign in with questions, we make a sincere attempt to answer all those questions, at least briefly, during the first hour. So, in theory, a person doesn't have to wait for more than 1 hour to at least get a partial answer. At the end of that hour, if Mel's available, he'll tell us what his mailbag is showing for the new recruits that are sending us in questions. We also will quite possibly hear Paul WS2N give us a space report to tell us the latest of what NASA has been doing. The subjects discussed on the TechNet are primarily the subjects that you guys bring as questions. Once in a blue moon, we have a prepared subject matter, but you select the questions most of the time. Beyond the first hour, we get into deeper subjects. The real ham radio operator, in my opinion, inside of that ham radio operator, there is a scientist trying to get out. So mankind makes real progress by showing curiosity, and you'll hear people with curiosity about everything to do with electronics, radio, physics, the atomic level, up to all the way up to the galactic level. And that subject matter doesn't please everybody, but know ahead of time it's going to take place, and therefore if it doesn't please you after the first hour period, up until midnight, so to speak, you can tune to some other subject. You'll occasionally hear disruptive people on the TechNet. For the most part, we ignore them, and we feel sorry for them, because in most cases, what's going on is that the person hears people enjoying the interchange taking place on the subjects of ham radio, for instance, and for some reason, their life is not so pleasing to them, and they think if they disrupt other people's pleasure, they'll be happier. It's a sad situation. We shouldn't be mad at them. We should feel sorry for them, from my point of view. Okay, a person signs into the technical net by getting Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in to tell us you're listening. This net has been around since 1982, September. That means we're in our 29th year and 1 month. This is TechNet number 1371 of the series that began way back in 1982. By now, we believe people in the tri-state area are listening. And that's part of what's going on. And the TechNet tries to tap into all that brain power that exists in northern New Jersey, southern New York, Long Island, and Connecticut. So please give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question for a comment. And give us that sign in right now. K2RIW, we're listening.
KC2MDT, see you then, yes.
We got you, Steve. Anyone else?
K2YO, yes.
That mysterious person was Bernie. We got you, Bernie. Anyone else?
WS2N, Paul with the S.
About time. Okay, WS2N. All righty. So far we got Steve, Bernie, and Paul. Anyone else?
No, Oscar.
I think that was in November 2, Echo Oscar. Very, very noisy, Rich. So you may have to move to another location. Anyone else? Okay, that's more than enough to get going. Steve, you're number one on the runway, and we'll discuss anything except antennas. That was a joke. You got it, Steve. KC2MDP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very, very good. Good evening to you. Good evening to everyone else on the net. Unfortunately, it is about antennas, but I'll give it to you anyway. And if you want to answer it, it's up to you. Just kidding. Dick, I'm looking to build a collinear array out of folded dipoles. I came across this program for a folded dipole that I can build it, and it should have a 200-ohm impedance. Now, my idea is to take four of these and basically, I guess, put them in parallel, you know, with the same exact length phasing line with T-connectors. Will this work? Any suggestions? I'll leave it up to you.
If you were putting four folded dipoles in parallel, assume your particular folded dipole design has got 200 ohms impedance, and if you could co-locate them and put four of them in parallel, in theory, you would end up with 50 ohms. Four things in parallel that are 200 ohms each makes a 50. In order for those dipoles to work correctly, you're going to be spacing them horizontally or vertically, whichever is your choice, depending on what pattern you want. You're going to be spacing them approximately a half wavelength in free space. And the nice thing about a half wavelength of transmission line, no matter what the transmission line is it repeats the impedance. So half wavelengths of transmission line or multiples of a half wavelength will give you at the far end of the transmission line, again, the repeated 200 ohms. And so therefore you could bring those four transmission lines together. The two center transmission lines would be a half wavelength each, and the two outer transmission lines would be maybe 1.5 wavelengths each. And you'd bring all four together at one point into a 50 ohm cable, and that would work rather well. So that's one of many ways of doing it. No one know for a fact, Steve, that there's nothing magic about making a dipole exactly half wavelength long. Let me drop. As you make the dipole less than half wavelength, the resistive component goes down. As you make the dipole longer than half wavelength, the resistive component goes up. So by adjusting nothing but the length of the dipole, whether it be an ordinary dipole set in the center, folded dipole, almost doesn't matter. By changing the length of the dipole, you can make the resistive component go anywhere from 1 ohm to 1,500 ohms, inclusive, continuously. Each one of those lengths where you select a particular resistive component, with rare exception, is almost always going to be a reactive component left over, unless it's exactly just electronically a half wavelength long. This is where the reactance goes through zero. Shorter than half wave, the reactance is capacitive. Longer than half wave, the reactance is inductive. By putting a shunt component at the center, you can therefore kill the reactive component and left with the resistive component. So the reason I'm telling all this to you is that once you build the whole antenna and put it all together, if you get something like a 1.3 standing wave ratio, you'll be happy. If you want to go the next step and make it a more perfect impedance, and by way of your antenna analyzer that you borrow from somebody if you don't already own one, you'll find out, is the resistor component high or low, or is there a reactive component, and there's ways you can adjust that. You'd be amazed how many people think that in order to adjust the resistive component of a dipole, you've got to do these elaborate things by making it a triple folding thing, or make it a delta match or a T match and so on. They think all of these other physical structures are required to adjust the impedance of the antenna. Nowhere near that complicated. Just adjusting the length and putting a shunt capacitor usually in the center, and you can get any impedance you want. That's the so-called Brown and Woodward curves, which are in the fourth chapter of almost every issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. Or you can go to the website.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You can go to the website where those curves have been published, and by going to www.whiskeyalpha1mikebravoalpha.org. You go to, that's the Tom Williams website. You go to the bottom of that first page, and you'll see Yagi impedance matching information by K2RIW. And there you'll see these curves that I'm talking about. Once you know the length of your antenna and the diameter of the material you made the antenna out of, Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward did about a man year's worth of work way back in 1948. And so for every reasonable diameter and length of antenna, dipole-like antenna, it's actually a monopole, but a monopole back-to-back is a dipole, you can predict ahead of time exactly what resistive component, what reactive component you're going to get. Therefore, you can plan it all on paper ahead of time. Or it can tell you which way to go if you want to modify it to make a... whether your antenna analyzer tells you your resistive component is too low or too high, or the reactive component is too capacitive or too inductive. So you could make this into a science if you want to, or you could do cut and try. There's lots of ways of doing it. But a collinear three or four element array of dipoles, like if it was a vertical stack, for instance, you should get approximately 6 dB of gain over one dipole, That'll be around 8 dB over isotropic, and as a Station Master-like homebrew antenna, with rare exception, that should give you a lot of very nice performance, Steve. Let us know how that project turns out. KC2MDP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, let that go by.
Okay, yes, Dick, very good. Yeah, I came across a program that basically gave me all that information as far as the diameter. I'm using a half-inch copper tubing with the, you know, copper-forming 90s and so forth. And I built the folded dipoles, and they are about 4 to 1. Now, my only question is it critical to use multiples of quarter wave? What I did is I went out and I bought four 10-foot lengths of, I forget what it is now, I'm not sure. I got it at Radio Shack. I figured they were pre-made, they were all going to be exactly the same length. And I was just going to bring them down, stick them in like a PVC box at the base of the antenna and put my T-connector and so forth in there. How critical is that? Should I cut those to multiple wavelengths, the frequency, or can I leave them at the 10-foot length? Back to you.
The first thing you didn't tell us, Steve, is what frequency is this antenna on. If it was on 2 meters or 6 meters, for instance, half-inch diameter copper tubing for the antenna is very large. So let me start off first. What frequency is this antenna on, Steve?
This antenna is actually going to be on UHF. It's going to be, I'm trying to build this antenna for a repeater for the business band.
I think you're saying 460 megacycles. So to make half-wave folded coax, I think you did say folded dipoles. To make folded dipoles at 450 megacycles, where each dipole is going to be in the vicinity of 12 inches long, and to make them out of copper tubing, half-inch diameter, my goodness, is that much heavier than you have to. If you're building that to survive a hurricane or a tornado, yeah, that's a way to go. I'm wondering what makes you decide to build roughly 12-inch long dipoles out of half-inch copper tubing. Give me a few words on that one, Steve.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, the main reason I did this is I built other antennas out of copper tubing, and I figure rather than, you know, trying to just take, you know, let's say, you know, a rod or something and trying to bend it and get it the exact, you know, exact diameters, it was just easier to, you know, take the copper tubing, cut it to the exact length, and, you know, basically do it like that. It was just stuff I had on hand. I had the copper pipe and everything. It was just a matter of, you know, what was in the junk drawer. Back to you.
Okay. It's going to work like a charm, but it doesn't have to be anywhere that thick and heavy. If you did want to use copper tubing, you could have used quarter-inch diameter copper tubing with the right kind of either threaded or solderable fittings. Could have been made lighter if you wanted to. Now, in order for, you have reason to believe that each one of your folded dipoles is going to be 200 ohms impedance. And in order for those four to be 200 ohms four times in parallel, you want your individual pieces of transmission line not to be equal to each other, but to be multiples of a half wavelength long. At a half wavelength long, impedance gets repeated. If you choose any other wavelength shorter or longer than a half wavelength, then you get an impedance inversion function. In other words, if you put 200 ohms on one side, and if it was an odd number of quarter wavelength long, you'd get something like 12 ohms on the other side, if you know what I mean. It's impedance inversion factor. So you've got a dual requirement. If you really want the impedance of each dipole to be thoroughly repeated, you want half wavelength intervals. And in order for the two outer dipoles to be in phase with the inner dipoles, and yes, you want the difference in wavelength between the inner set and the outer set on the transmission lines to be one wavelength different if they're all stacked identically, or half wavelength difference if you make the outer ones upside down from the inner ones in the way you feed them. In other words, if you fed them all in phase as far as their placement in space is concerned. The semiconductor of the coax would go to the upper half of each one of the four dipoles. Each piece of coax cable would go to the upper half. Well, if you make the semiconductor of the coax go to the lower half...
Repeater, time out.
If you make the semiconductor of the coax cable go to the lower half of the dipoles on the top one and the bottom one, but the upper half of the dipoles on the two center ones, then you've got this half wavelength of difference. Now the cables going to the outer set and the cables going to inner set should differ by a half wave. So in other words, half wave of cable, 180 degrees of phase shift, but by the way you feed the dipoles, you make another 180 degree phase shift, and it comes out equal. So if you want the impedances to repeat, you're going to make electronically the cables halfway long, including the velocity factor. In order for the outer set and the inner set, assuming you're feeding it in the exact center, the outer set and the inner set to be in phase, you either make the differences in those cable lengths one wavelength different, like the inner set the half wave and the outer set one and a half, one and a half wavelengths, or you make them a half wavelength apart if you invert the way you feed them. I know that's a little bit mixed up in the way I said it, but maybe you got the point of all that one. So you got this two requirements. Certain length of cable so you repeat impedance. Certain length of cable so that everything comes out in phase as far as what you're finally radiating. KC2MDP, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Dick. Yeah, I think I sort of get the gist of what you're saying. Back to you.
So, one way of doing it would be, yes, four cables that are more than long enough, and you're going to coil the center ones to take care of the extras and make sure that they're all some number of half wavelengths long. And would 10 feet do that? Well, you got to find out what is the velocity factor of your cable. And if it's not exactly a half wavelength electronically, then you're going to get this funny impedance inversion. 200 ohm impedance on a 50 ohm cable could come out 12 ohms instead of 200 ohms on the input end of each individual cable if the cables are an odd number of quarter wavelengths long. An even number of quarter wavelengths long impedance equals each other on each end. An odd number of quarter wavelengths long, you get impedance inversion. So you may have to play that back in your mind a few times in order for that to make some sense. Good luck with that project. You're allowed to ask us more questions in the future weeks as you're starting to test this thing. And one way of proving that the pattern is just right would be to lay the whole antenna horizontal and do a test on an antenna range where you slowly rotate the antenna in azimuth while measuring the peak of beam, and you'll find out whether or not the elevation is on the horizon where you want it, if you know what I mean. So it would be a good idea to do the pattern check, because people building collinear arrays sometimes end up with the pancake pattern above the horizon or below the horizon, and that could hurt a little bit. The next person was Bernie, K2 Yankee Oscar. What would you like to talk about tonight, Bernie? K2RIW in the TechNet. K2 Yankee Oscar, are you still there, Bernie? Okay, maybe Bernie got called away. We'll come back to him. Paul was the next person. WS2N, go right ahead, Paul. K2RIW.
Very good, Dick. Yeah, I had a question. This is in regards, well, it's a cross between a technical question and a space topic. Years ago, back in 1960, they had a satellite that went up called Echo. And this thing lasted like for almost 8 years. They bounced signals off of it. It was nothing but a gigantic balloon, 100 feet in diameter. You might remember that, Dick. You're no kid, so you might remember that story. And in fact, it set another one up a little bit bigger years later. And they bounce signals off it. I'm just wondering what signals, what frequencies do you think they bounced off of it. I've searched the internet. The only thing I could find is they used it for a phone-to-phone communication. And also they sent an image of Eisenhower. They bounced that off of Echo. Let me drop it. I'm wondering if you remember what frequencies would be possible. They did say also on the internet that the Wilson and the other guy, they built that 50-foot horn. You know, the guys that discovered the background radiation. They were using that in the process of playing around with tuning up that antenna. That's where they discovered the microwave radiation. So a lot of things, you know, indirectly came from this Echo mission. And the reason I ask is, you know, this thing was 100 feet in diameter. I wonder if anybody's tried to bounce signals off the International Space Station. Actually, bounce them off, you know. I mean, you could do it. I mean, I would think the space station is even bigger than this 100-foot diameter balloon. According to space.com, on that website, they did say amateurs also tried to bounce signals off this balloon. But nowhere anywhere does it say what band, what frequency, what mode. Well they did say an image mode and phone to phone. But no frequency or band. Back over to you. WS2.
JB2, JXM.
JXN recognized, KB2. Are you signing in, giving us your name, got an opinion on the subject? Mr. JXN, go ahead.
Okay. This is Gary here, JXM. This is Michael. No, that's a different subject.
Okay. We're signing you in as a sign-in number 5. We got one guy ahead of you after Paul. Paul, the magic of a round balloon-like object, a round spherical metallic object, is that it does not favor any frequency. The standard echo device for testing a radar sensitivity is a metallic sphere. And the amount of echo you get out of the sphere is exactly equal to the projected area. In other words, if you assume that sphere of metal was casting a shadow on the ground and the sun was shining, and assuming the sun was a point source, you would and the sun's a long distance away, you would get a certain amount of square feet of area of shadow on the ground. That number of square feet of area tells you exactly how much echo you're going to get on each and every frequency. So the nice thing about a round device is that it gives you an echo on every frequency and doesn't favor any particular frequency, and you get a little bit stronger echo as you go to higher frequencies because of the way it displays a little bit more retrodirective gain. That's called the radar cross-section effect of a spherical object. If you go to the radar handbook by Skolnick, the Skolnick radar handbook, and you look at the section called radar cross-section, and they'll tell you what radar cross-section you get for a corner reflector and a flat plate and a round sphere, and they'll give you a curve. You could Google the word radar cross-section and round sphere, and you'll find out mathematically exactly how much echo you're going to get. Let me drop. Now, on that Project Echo experiment, they had a very large hoghorn-like dish, very similar to the Penzias-Wilson dish at Bell Laboratories in Holmdel. They had an antenna installation just like that in Maine. I can't think of the name of the town in Maine where they set that up. There's a beautiful Bell System technical in Andover. Was that Andover, did you say?
Yes, I was there in 1967, W2CH.
W2CH, okay. We're going to be talking, going right back to you and finding out exactly what that Andover, Maine installation was like. And I am guessing that they used S-band frequencies, S-band, C-band, or X-band in that vicinity. Somewhere between 2 and 10 gigs is my guess. And Mr. 2CH is going to correct me on that one. By reflecting off that echo balloon to, I think there was a station in London, in the United Kingdom, there's one in France, and by talking through it, by echo, you were able to send information.
The project wasn't too successful from my point of view because meteorites hitting the balloon eventually collapsed it, and it didn't keep its shape. Also, the balloon is low in mass. It's got a lot of area, so it doesn't stay in orbit very long. And if you put up the electronic equivalent, a real satellite with amplification, you get a lot more signal for the money, if you know what I mean. Whiskey 2, Charlie Hotel. Please start off with your name, sir, and tell us what it was like in Andover, Maine, with that particular installation during the ECHO project. W2CH, start off with your name. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Yes, Dick, and Dean at W2CH. Name here is Ray Romeo Alpha Yankee. And I was just there at the visitor. I'm sorry to sound complete because I wouldn't know a lot of specific details. But I was up there in 1967 in the fall, and there was a dome over it with a horn antenna that would rotate to follow the satellite. I'm not sure how much it was doing with ECHO. It might have been involved with Telstar, but you were able to go in. There was a pressure in there to keep the dome up, and that's where it was working from up there. As far as other details specifically about it, I can't help you with that, except what I saw back then as a visitor.
Very fine, Ray, and thank you for that information. There may have been more than one site in Maine. Andover sounds like one of them, but I thought there was another one. There was also another project that preceded it called Project Westford. And in the case of Project Westford, they launched a satellite that had millions and millions of tiny little whisker dipoles that got dispersed in space, and the intention was to make this ring of dipoles floating freely in space in orbit around the planet, and you would aim your antenna at the ring of little dipoles as a reflecting object and therefore send the signal over the horizon on microwave frequencies. So if you Google the word Project Westford, W-E-S-T-F-O-R-D, and then Project ECHO, guaranteed there's a lot of good IEEE information on the subject. Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers is what it's called now, and then it was called IRE, Institute of Radio Engineers. They changed the name somewhere around, I guess, 1968 or so. Passive satellite reflecting is a fun project. I've done it by reflecting signals on 432 megacycles off of aircraft flying at 35,000 feet. I did that experiment for four solid years when me and K2CAW in Greensboro, North Carolina, 480 miles away, we were reflecting signals off of aircraft. That wasn't our intention in the beginning, but we soon found out what was going on. So, can you reflect signals? Let me drop. So, reflecting signals on aircraft that are high enough up that are in the mutual beam of these two antennas, there's a lot of Earth curvature on that 480 miles and what I did. And could you reflect off of the space shuttle? Absolutely. I was going to run such an experiment with a guy in Alabama, but he became a silent key before we had a chance to do it. But with modern-day computer programs, we can predict exactly where the satellite's going to be, and therefore on both ends you know where to aim it. It's not too different from what ham radio operators do when they're doing a meteor scatter, moonbound. In any case, when you've got an object in the sky, it doesn't matter if the object is metallic or not, it's going to reflect some signal. You just get a little bit of difference in the amplitude. You could put up an airplane made out of fiberglass, but because the fiberglass is so much more dense than the free space around it, you're going to get an echo off. It's just a couple of dB weaker than you would if it was made out of pure aluminum. So you put any object in the mutual beam that's high enough up so with Earth curvature they can both see it, you can get a predictable amount of echo. You can calculate ahead of time how many watts you're transmitting, how good is your receiving system, and whether or not that signal will be above threshold. I had a conversation today, for instance, with VE4MA, one of the very progressive microwave guys. Barry Malawanchuk is his name, and he's doing experiments right now on 24 gigahertz, 47 gigahertz, and he's tuning up for, I think it's 85 gigahertz, moon bounce. It's so high a frequency you and I would normally get a nosebleed going up there. And so the moon is giving him an echo at these super high frequencies. For him to get a hold of the right kind of traveling wave tube, there's still got some gain left. within the price that he can afford on the surplus market. That's part of what's going on. And there's an interesting set of controversies going on as to what the echo sounds like off the moon. Does the signal get the Doppler spreading because of
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
And does the signal get Doppler spreading because of the moon libration effect? So any object you put in the mutual beam of two antennas is going to give you a predictable amount of echo. That echo is predictable by the science called radar cross-section. The radar people have worked this one out a long time ago, as I see it, Paul. And when you're transmitting and receiving from the exact same site, that's called monostatic radar echo. When you transmit from one site and receive at another site, it's called bistatic radar echo. But the radar cross-section, bistatic or monostatic echo, and once you know the shape of the object, where it's located, how many miles between you and it, and so on, it's all predictable ahead of time. On paper, you can decide, hey, I'm going to be 3 dB above threshold, or I'm going to be 10 dB below threshold, and you know how much you've got to change the power in the antenna gain and the noise figure accordingly. So as crazy as it sounds, Paul, nowadays it's almost an art. It's almost a science where you can predict ahead of time. Darn good subject. WS2N. Wonder what's got you on this one, Paul. K2RIW in the TechNet.
I was thinking the space station's always going over. You know, they have packets and all kinds of radio equipment. But, you know, it'd be nice to use it as a relay station. You could bounce signals off it. I was wondering if that would work. And naturally, that makes me think of the Echo Project. So I remember that when I was a kid. So, you know, you look it up. Here you go. You got all this information, but nothing about the frequencies. It's very good. Almost anything will bounce off of it. The, two questions I really have. The diameters of all the, I call them, let's see, the modules on the space station are roughly about 14 foot in diameter, every one of them, plus a gigantic truss section and 240 foot long solar panels. Your radio signals are going up and they're hitting this individual cylinders, which are smaller than 100 foot diameter sphere. I wonder if that would make a difference of what frequencies would be able to be transmitted and bounced off the space station. Another question, let me drop it. The physics behind this, you know, you've got this round ball. It's not really a mirror that's looking down back at the Earth. It's nothing but a big, gigantic round ball. So part of your signal is going to hit the front of the ball first, and then 45 degrees up, it's going to hit another part of the ball. And I'm thinking that's going to bounce away, not back toward Earth, but, you know, out to Venus somewhere, you know, on another angle. You know, it's a round thing. You know, so I was wondering, you know, I thought maybe you would send a signal up and only one little piece of your signal is going to come back. You know, really not much. I wonder what you think about it. Think about that question. Back to you.
You're using good common sense, Paul, and you're thinking about what's called the specular reflection. If it was a mirror surface ball, and you're speaking optically, the words you use are exactly right. You get a nice echo off the point of the sphere that's directly in the center from your point of view, and the other portions of the sphere scatter the signal into all other directions. Radar cross-section is measured with a round sphere because at radio frequencies, that current crawls along that metallic surface, and it really radiates from the sphere in almost every single direction. You're lighting up the sphere with radio energy, and it squirts out the signal in every single direction, almost equal. You get a little bit stronger echo in the retro-directive direction, but in all other directions, you're still getting a pretty good signal. As the sphere gets larger and larger, the portion of the sphere that gives you the biggest echo is that portion right in the center from your point of view. As the sphere gets larger, the radius of curvature gets larger. Therefore, the portion that's directly facing you becomes flatter and flatter, and it gives you a better and better signal. The bottom line of all this is that you tell somebody the diameter of the sphere, he can tell you exactly how much echo you're going to get, and it doesn't favor any particular frequency. Now, there's a couple of frequencies where you get a little bit stronger signal where the circumference is an exact multiple of a wavelength. But as the sphere gets bigger and bigger, that factor starts wiping out, if you know what I mean. So now, in the case of the echo you're going to get from a very complicated structure like the International Space Station, let me drop. All those complicated structures in the International Space Station will obey the law of superposition. Each individual spherical object of each one of those modules is giving you a predictable amount of echo. They're all at a particular position in space. You take the echo of each one of those, convert it into a voltage, and then with the geometry of your sending and receiving site, you figure out in a vector manner how all of those voltages add together. That's going to give you the composite echo. My gut feel is that if you really aim a signal at the space station, the biggest echo you're going to get is off the solar panel. They have the most amount of area. And if you happen to be lucky enough that the orientation is just right, that you're getting a specular reflection, in other words, the solar panels are just aimed right to act as a mirror, giving you a perfect reflection between the transmitting side and the receiving side, you're going to get a whopping big signal. So has echo been bounced off of the space station? Absolutely. Have many amateurs used it? Very few. But the microwave enthusiasts from time to time talk about using the space shuttle, the International Space Station, Skylab, aircraft, satellite, meteors, the meteor trail, ionization, whatever. Any object you put in the middle of that radio beam will scatter some signal. And the only thing left to discuss is how strong will the scatter be, and is it above threshold for the equipment you're using. So it's time you start building that mini moon bounce set up there and start bouncing off of the International Space Station instead of the moon. You'll get a lot bigger echo, Paul, and it happens more frequently. So is Ronkonkoma about to have a moon bounce ham radio site, WS2N, K2RIW on the TechNet?
Thanks, Tom. Well, what is... I'm just thinking that. Now, you take the moon, now what is that, a half a degree of arc, and the space station is probably, you know, I would say 1/20 of it, one of probably even less than that. So, don't you still have a bigger surface on the moon outside of the power that you need to get there? You've got a better shot of hitting it. I would think the moon would still be better. Space station, although being closer, maybe that little piece that's coming back, you know, maybe that would be stronger, but you're going to get a bigger section from the moon, correct?
The moon gives you a bigger echo if you had a level playing field. But the moon is a quarter of a million miles away, 240,000 miles away, and that space station from you and I, at the time you and I are looking at it, is 300 miles away. That signal always obeys inverse square law. In other words, the signal as it goes more and more miles is getting weaker and weaker. Although the number of degrees that's subtended by the International Space Station is very small compared to the number of degrees of the moon, half a degree from the moon, yes, you'd think you're going to get a bigger echo from the moon. But by the time that signal goes a quarter of a million miles to get there, bounces off the moon, and then comes a quarter of a million miles back to Earth, that signal is going to be a hell of a lot weaker. Very rough rule of thumb. On 432 megacycle ham radio frequencies, if you had an isotropic antenna transmitting on the Earth, moon bounce, and then an isotropic antenna receiving, 263 decibels of loss round trip to the moon and back, 263 dB. That's the path loss you've got to overcome. You overcome it by using 1,000 watts of transmitter power. That's plus 60 dB over a milliwatt, plus 60 dBm, So you're using 1,000 watts of transmitter power. You're using 30 decibels of antenna gain. That's another 1,000-to-1 ratio. You're using 400 square feet of receiving area on receive, another 30 dB gain antenna. And you're using a receiver that's got a very low noise figure and can receive a signal of minus 140 dBm. You put all those numbers together. You know that the moon, one way there and back to simple antennas, is 263 dB. You add up all the pluses you got from your transmit power, your receiver sensitivity, your transmit antenna gain, your receiver noise figure, your receiver effective capture area.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You add up all those noise together, all those numbers together, Paul, and you can predict ahead of time on paper, am I 3 dB ahead of the game or 5 dB behind the game on the setup I've got in my backyard right now to do moon mass. And people have made those calculations, done the real experiment, and you come out very close. So it is a group of mathematics. So you're going to get a much bigger echo off of the International Space Station. I'm going to make a rough guess. It's going to be 25 decibels stronger because it's a hell of a lot closer. Over to you, Paul. And it's time to start setting up all that equipment. And lots of people on Long Island will be excited by the project and join you. WS2N, K2LIW.
Says they're very good. The wireless quick question then. I realize the balloon. Okay, that's a almost perfect. I guess like the moon. The moon is the same idea. That's a big round ball. So the same idea there. But now, how come I need a parabolic dish to feed on to trans my signals up and receive them to the satellite? Why have big expenses? Well, not that it's too expensive, but a costly parabolic dish. You know, can you just put up a big maybe a bunch of chicken wire, just straight? It doesn't matter then. It's all going to be reflected back anyway. Where am I going wrong there?
What happens with radio and what happens with light, which are different portions of the exact same electromagnetic spectrum, the physics is the same. When you and I pick up a flashlight, that flashlight has got a light bulb in the center and it's got a parabolic reflector that gives you a real strong beam in one direction. And as you aim that flashlight at the road in front of you, while you're walking down the road, that road in front of you is nice and bright. You could, if you want to, take the flashlight apart. In theory, you could remove the parabolic reflector and just have the light bulb sitting there shining the light all over the place. Well, that exact same number of watts out of that light bulb is going to be very dim. You're not going to have, it's going to be very difficult to see the road at nighttime that you're walking in front of, that's in front of you as you walk, because you're not focusing the energy. So the whole idea of a parabolic dish, you take this very valuable amount of energy that you transmit, your kilowatt out of your transmitter, and by squirting it very carefully directly at the moon, you make the moon you light up the moon a hell of a lot brighter with your radio flashlight by using a parabolic dish. At microwave frequencies, arguably the highest gain antenna is a parabolic focusing surface. The highest gain antenna on planet Earth a few years ago used to be the Palomar 200-foot telescope, the optical telescope at Palomar in California. Because it is 200 inches in diameter, but because the wavelength is 450 nanometers at the optical frequencies, it's got a zillion wavelengths of diameter. Therefore, Palomar as a parabolic reflector has a gain of 148 decibels. That's a high gain antenna. It really squirts the energy in one direction. If you put a flashlight at the eyepiece of the Mount Palomar telescope.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You put a flashlight on the eyepiece of the Mount Palomar telescope, where instead of using it as an optical receiver as a telescope, using it as an optical transmitter. Works equally as well. I've done that experiment. And now you aim Mount Palomar at the moon. you're going to get a lot more light on the moon with Palomar than if you do it directly with your own flashlight. I have taken my laser pointer, put it at the eyepiece of my 8-inch diameter Schmidt-Cassegrain telescope, which is a quasi-parabolic reflector, and I can aim that thing half a mile down the road and put a real sharp green dot on that 30-mile-an-hour speed sign in front of my house half a mile down the road when I aim my telescope in that direction and put my laser pointer at the eyepiece of the telescope. If I did it directly with the laser pointer, almost no light can be seen that long a distance, if you know what I mean. So you can see that the gain of the transmitting antenna and squirting all the signal in the direction you care about instead of smearing it all over space allows you to overcome those 263 dB of path loss real fast. You need that in order to make it work. Wonder if that makes a little more sense, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I got it.
No problem. Very good, Dick.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, I remember playing around years ago drawing a parabolic line on graph paper, and you come in with the light rays. I was fascinated by, you know, the angle of, you know, incident, wherever it hits, coming back all to the same point. You know, when you have this, well, you make them all the exact same distance, and it's amazing that the parabolic focal point winds up in the same spot. Whether you have a big dish or a small dish, it's always relatively exactly in the same place, you know, as long as that parabolic line is drawn correctly. So I realize that, you know, that's the way to go. But you know, when you were talking about the balloon, I said, well, put a balloon in front of the feed horn would work. But, of course, I realize that would cause a problem. After that, good explanation, Dick. Very good. I'll listen to the rest of the net. I'll be standing by, Dick. WS1.
Yeah, the mathematics of a parabola is y equals ax squared. A is a constant, x is the radius from the center, and y is how much you bend the surface toward the focal point, so to speak. The magic of that parabolic reflecting surface is that not only does every square inch of it meet the requirement of angle of incidence equals angle of reflection, therefore the incoming signal always gets focused to that one point called the focal point, but it's got another piece of magic, and that is you trace every one of those path lengths, assuming that the signal came from a long distance away, therefore the signal comes at you as a planar phase front. You start off with that planar phase front, and every one of those signal paths from that planar phase front hits the parabola, has just the right angle to aim the signal toward the focal point, and every one of those path lengths is the exact same number of inches. So that not only does the signal get all focused to the right point, but every one of those signals are in phase with each other, no matter where in the parabola it hits, near the center, halfway out, near the perimeter, doesn't matter. They all turn out in phase. That's the magic. Now, you could, if you want to, make a so-called collinear antenna, a completely flat antenna, by starting off with a flat reflector, and then smear a zillion dipoles across that flat reflector. So light up the flat reflector, that signal for you. You can do that. The problem is that at 432 megacycles, to do a good moon bounce, you want 400 square feet of antenna. That's going to be something like 100 separate dipoles in front of your reflector. The phasing harness to feed 100 individual dipoles is going to drive you up a wall. But you make
repeater, timeout, cancel.
But you start off with one single parabola of the same projected area and one simple dipole plus reflector at the focal point lights up the whole thing and gives you the same gain. So instead of having a 100-to-1 power divider to feed your 100 dipoles if you're building a flat antenna, you have essentially one dipole feeding the whole dot antenna if you're willing to shape it into a parabolic shape. So you get a lot more bang for the money out of a parabola. So you'll notice that almost all of the serious ham radio operators or any of the serious commercial communication systems above 1,000 megacycles, 90-some-odd% of them are using a parabola. The others are using various kinds of horns. But most serious high-gain microwave antennas are a parabola. That's not a coincidence. It's the magic surface that gives you the mostest for the leastest. So it's time you and I study the mathematics of a parabola, get familiar with it, and learn how to build one. And I had a homebrew one that was on the front cover of QST, August 1972 issue. And the article inside tells you how to make this 12-foot diameter parabolic dish that allowed me to listen to that very weak 10-watt signal from the Apollo 15 astronauts when they were on the moon. So I used the parabola to do that. I wonder if you've ever seen that picture, Paul. Go ahead.
I remember trying looking that picture up on the internet, and I couldn't find it. You know, you're supposed to be able to find old copies of QST, but I don't know. Couldn't find it. It's been a hand since September of '86, so that predated me. So I've saved every QST copy since. So more by a few years. I'll try searching the archives again. At CARRL, maybe I'll come up with it. Fact you think.
Yeah, Paul, as long as you are an ARRL current member, you have access to all of the past archives of QST Magazine. And if you Google, if you do an archive search for KQRIW, August 1972, QST, you'll find the article about the 12-foot parabolic dish. However, I don't know why, but every other time that I use the archives, I know the exact name, it's me, I know the exact call letters, it's mine, I know the exact month, I know the exact page number. I can put all of that information into the QST archive search, and it says there's no such record. And I say, you blankety-blank fibbers, no way in hell. There's something crazy about that particular archive search. You give up that day and you do the exact same search the next day, or just search for K2RIW in 1972. And in theory, they should give you a list of articles. And you do the exact same search an hour later or a day later, and it finds it. But half the time I do a search, and it says it doesn't exist. So there's something very persnickety about that particular archival search, Paul.
Dick?
Yeah, go ahead, Andy.
Hey, I tried the same thing, Dick, at one time. I think it was 93, June. The upfront section, I made it in there, but I don't know. I can't find it online either.
Dick?
Yeah, go ahead, Andy.
For Paul's information, the ARRL antenna handbook under Space Communications section has your article on this best parabolic dish, and it shows a picture of you with the dish and about it.
Okay, so it's is that the latest issue of the ARRL antenna book? I know it's also in the microwave manual. That particular article is in quite a few places. So is it the latest and greatest version of the ARRL antenna book? Over to you, Andy.
I'm not sure if it's the latest one. I have one that goes back a few years to the late 2000, 2008, 2007. And I know it's in there. So it's probably in the later one. I would think so.
Yeah, to my knowledge, Paul, that particular article on that 12-foot stressed parabolic dish is in about four or five of the ARRL publications. So the antenna book, various versions have it. The microwave manual had it, one of the microwave manuals. The original QST of August 1972 had it, and it's been reprinted a couple of other times. Okay, we're going to move on to the next person. Let me go back to Bernie and see if Bernie has come back. K2 Yankee Oscar, who signed in with a question. Are you back, Bernie? K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, Bernie really got called away. The next person who signed in, I think, was Rich, N2EO. Give us a brief transmission, Rich, and see if your signal strength is going to be good from where you are now. N2EO, K2RIW.
Yeah, I'm downstairs now. I was having supper and spoke to you on the HT. Dick, I sent you an email with pictures of the 6-meter kilowatt that I built out of an SP220. Got a couple of questions for you. I admittedly don't have enough drive. I've got about 60 watts of drive, getting 500 watts output with a pair of 3-500Zs. The input is about 550 mils and about 2,500 volts under load. So the efficiency, I don't know, maybe I can't expect better efficiency than that on a pair of 3,500s. The glass trials, they're running kind of like, kind of a QST article, but they're running kind of like toward the limit. I think those tubes only can run up to about 70 megs. Let me let it reset. That's the first thing I wanted to ask you. I got to get a transmitter here and put 100 watts of drive into it to see what I get out of it. Because according to the guy who wrote the article, with 100 watts of drive, he was getting 1,100 watts an hour. Which makes sense. It's a linear. If I put 25 watts in, I'm getting 250 watts out. If I put 50 watts in, 60 watts in, I'm getting 500. So it is running proportional. It is linear. What I wanted to ask you, Dick, on the Heathkit SP220, the original circuit, they don't ground the grid directly. And I'm wondering why. What they do is they put a 1 millihenry choke off each grid to ground, and there are three pins. They got three capacitors, 200 picofarads, silver mices. I'm wondering why they're doing that. Is that some kind of a resonant circuit or what? I have a reason for asking. Looking at the Ameritron AL82, which is essentially the same amplifier design, they ground the grids directly. Back to that, into EO.
6DPZ with comments.
Go ahead, Hal.
Okay. Number one, I experienced in the past with high-power amplifiers that sometimes the plate voltage meter and the current meters are not accurate. So I suggest the first thing is make sure your meters are reading accurately by double-checking the calibration of the meters and then work from there for K6 dark purple zombies.
Even so, even if he had 10% error in his meters, Hal, where he's putting 550 mils at 2,500 volts, he's putting 1,375 watts in, getting 500 watts out, that's an apparent plate efficiency of 36%. And although it's linear, and in theory a linear can approach 50% efficiency, 36% is a little lower than he'd like to have. When you start driving it a little harder, you'll find out a little bit more about what's going on. The first question I would ask to make sure that the tubes are happy is that when you're adjusting the tuning and loading controls and you're looking at power output on your Berg watt meter or any other kind of hopefully accurate power output indicator into a known good 50 ohm dummy load, when you adjust the tuning and loading control on the plate and any controls you've got on the grid, and even if the grid circuit doesn't have any controls, let me drop this. You have the equivalent of grid tuning control by adjusting either the length of cable between the driver and the final, and or adjusting the tuning and loading controls on the driver. And if I know you, you might be using a Collins rig to do the drive, and it really has tuning and loading control. So directly or indirectly, you have tuning of the grid, you have tuning of the plate, and as long as all of those controls do not truly run out of range. In other words, no one of those capacitors is hitting maximum or minimum capacitance, so to speak. If all of those controls are not running out of range, then in theory you're getting everything that those particular tubes can give you. Now, why they use a choke on the grid as opposed to directly grounding the grid, I'm not sure. I can see a slight advantage of resonating the grid. It turns out that the grid has a certain electrical length. between the real phase center of that control grid deep inside that tube, and you trace, you make believe you're an electron, and once